Welcome back, everyone. My name is Terry Bollins. I'm your host, the Senior Survival Source. We're here to help you with enhanced wellness at any age and preserve financial resources. Our website is seniorsurvivalsource.com. You can always reach my office at 916-671-5777. By the way, on our website, you can get the free care roadmap. It's absolutely free. Just download it. We are joined now by Amy Ochi. And before we start that conversation, I just want to kind of revisit one thing. So in Henry Brumley's situation, and again, thank you, Henry, for your participation today, he was dealing with a component of diminished capacity, that is Alzheimer's and dementia. So when we talk about diminished capacity, there's another take on that. We want to know what it means, what the limitations are as it relates to choices in care, medical treatment, legal documents, and what's the legal standard for diminished capacity? Again, I want to point out, folks, this is not just limited to, you know, old people, because there are three women I cited in just a recent radio show. There were all women under the age of 40. They were all had lost capacity entirely and were being treated, in some cases, against the family's will. So Henry's talked about Alzheimer's and dementia, how he sees people struggle with periodic treatment options. LA is a great integrated care team. But the subject of diminished capacity and what we can do in terms of self-determination, it can be and is confusing. So I want to welcome Amy Ochi, a licensed estate planning attorney, to join our conversation. Welcome, Amy, to Senior Survival Source.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Terry.
You're more than welcome. Now, before we get started, can you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself and your practice?
Yeah, I've been an attorney since 1993, first licensed in Arizona. Now I'm licensed in California, and I've lived here almost 15 years. My main office is by the Fountains in Roseville, but I also use office space in Sacramento, Grass Valley, and Yuba City. I practice estate planning and really enjoy being part of professional networks so I can get my clients the help that they need for their planning. I'd say for this work, perhaps my most practical training, however, is my own family. I am the baloney in the sandwich generation. I'm happily married, two kids, siblings, and my parents are still living on their own at ages 88 and 93.
Wow, there you go. That's a success story right there.
Yeah.
So now, after speaking with Henry on the subject of capacity, and we're clearly talking about self-determination, where does the concept of legal capacity come into play with medical decisions, Amy?
Well, in that realm, we call it informed consent, and that's probably a term people have heard before. As your first guest pointed out, every day, doctors, nurses, hospital administrators, they face this issue of determining someone's mental capacity and getting their informed consent to do medical procedures on them. Pretty much, it's not a perfunctory form you just sign as you walk in, but it involves a conversation that the healthcare provider has with the patient where they'll determine if the patient has this capacity to give informed consent.
So is there a medical, is there a test?
Yeah, I mean, what the guidelines, there really isn't a test where you put the information in and the answer spits out, but there are guidelines that physicians apply. And they are, first, can the patient respond knowingly and intelligently to questions about his or her treatment? Are they conscious? Can they communicate? And second, can the patient participate in that treatment decision using rational thought? Third, does the patient, even at a very minimal, basic level, understand what's wrong with them? You know, why are they at the hospital? Why are they at the doctor's office?
Not confused.
What medical treatment is being proposed? What are the potential risks and rewards of agreeing to that treatment? The consequences of not acting? And finally, does the patient understand what alternative treatments are available and what those potential risks and rewards are? But I want to point out that if a patient has legal capacity to accept this treatment, they can also refuse the treatment.
So I want to make sure that we touch on this one thing. So as I understand it, and I'm not a licensed attorney here, but a person can have diminished capacity. On one hand, consent to a medical procedure. On the other hand, not be allowed to enter into a legal document. Is that?
Well, in the area of informed consent, that's going to be a physician making that call.
I see.
And there, it's very fact specific.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. And right. I'll be honest with you. I mean, if the patient is responding rationally and agreeing to do for treatment that is in his or her best interest, the physician is going to err on the side of, yes, that person has the capacity to agree to this. But if they're proposing, you know, highly unusual things, then there's going to be a closer look.
I see. So now what I saw a horrible accident the other day. I was mountain biking over in the foothills, and we couldn't see the accident, but I did see a life flight helicopter. And I'm assuming in that situation, you could hear the ambulances and everything. So I'm assuming that this person was pretty injured. What happens if, like in that case, you're unconscious? What if you can't communicate and give informed consent?
Well, if you are admitted or, you know, emergency personnel come on the scene and you're unconscious, for one, they will attempt to see if there's an advanced health care directive on your person. You can keep one in your glove box, for example, in that automobile example that you gave. You can also have one with your physician, with your hospital. You can register it with the state of California. You can put it on your refrigerator, clearly marked, especially if you're at a time in your life where emergency personnel may have to come and revive you. But because, once again, this is very fact-specific, the law is somewhat malleable for allowing emergency personnel to provide the care that you need at that moment to keep you alive. So they'll take all reasonable measures to contact family members. They'll look at any identification that might be in your wallet. If you're brought into the hospital, they'll talk to the people who brought you in. But if you are then able to communicate, even in the most rudimentary way, they will listen to you and give you an opportunity to give consent for your treatment.
I see. So I think there's a really important comment that Amy just made, folks, and that is put it in writing and put it in your glove box. You know, even make a little card and put it in your wallet. I mean, these are really important things. This is not just like emergency phone numbers that somebody finds. This is a, hey, this is a either a do not resuscitate form or this is what I want kind of thing with your signature. It could really go a long way. Yeah, right?
Yeah, it can really go a long way. You can add other things into this document. Sometimes people will put issues about, let's say, cremation or burial in their will. Well, the fact of the matter is you don't look at someone's will until they've been passed away quite a while ago often. But that advanced health care directive is a place for you to put down your wishes, describe the kind of care you want. Do you want to have care provided in your home? Do you want extraordinary measures taken? Do you want life support? Do you want to be an organ donor? It is the document that is going to speak for you when you are not able to speak for yourself.
This is really important because we started the conversation off with the Bill of Rights and self-determination, and this document speaks for yourself in the event that you can't. Now, I mean, let me ask you another thing. So what happens if it's not a medical setting? What happens if a family sees the signs of confusion or short-term memory? What do you recommend in those circumstances?
Well, if you start seeing any of those signs, I recommend first and foremost that you do bring those concerns to your loved one's physician. So this can be diagnosed. Maybe it's a side effect of medication that can be altered and hopefully reversed. But you really raise a good point, Terry. This is something that's called diminished capacity. And that is, frankly, a lot of where the tension arises with families. I call it a gray area, and it spans many, many years in some cases.
Okay, so I really want to cut to the meat of the matter here. How do you avoid conservatorship, and how do you cover yourself? And what are the specific things that people can do to protect their lives?
Well, you use that legal term conservatorship. So let's define that for our listeners. Basically, if you have not put a power of attorney into effect, and a power of attorney is a document where somebody says, you can step into my shoes financially, you can make decisions on my behalf. If you have not put one of those into effect and that diminished capacity gets to a point where you are no longer able to make decisions, it's been determined that you do not have legal capacity, the family members would have to go to court and show that you do not have that legal capacity and obtain a conservatorship over you. It's an expensive process. It's time consuming. You lose control because the court is going to maintain oversight, and it is not granted lightly.
So if I understand this correctly, folks, we're talking about medical expenses, complicated, enhanced, exasperated perhaps by now legal expenses, because I understand we don't want to deal with this stuff, but you have to start thinking about this. From a legal perspective, what kind of test is there for mental capacity?
Well, to start with, the law presumes that adults have capacity. And if an adult can, even if someone has a severe mental illness, has schizophrenia, the law wants people to have control of their body, have control of their bank account. They assume that people have capacity and you have to prove otherwise, which is reflects back in our conversation about the difficulty in obtaining a conservatorship. The test for legal capacity, similar to with physicians, it's not a test where you put the data in and the answer spits out. You have to apply guidelines to, you know, specific facts, and they're very, you know, different in each person's case. But the person first needs to understand, what is the testamentary act? If they're going to sign a will, what does that even mean to sign a will? And a layperson's very rudimentary understanding of that is sufficient. Second, you need to know, what property do you own? You know, do you own your house? What possessions do you have? And third, you need to understand, who is your family? You know, regardless if you're going to leave money to your children or not, you at least need to know, who are my children? Do I have a spouse? Do I have siblings, parents, that sort of thing?
Or dependent children.
Yes, exactly.
Very interesting. So, do you have any actual examples that you can speak to about where you've dealt with that very situation?
I have. Really, I mean, every day when a client comes in, an attorney needs to make somewhat of a judgment call if that person has capacity, especially if there are signs that maybe there is some diminished capacity. You can speak to other attorneys. You can send your client to someone else for a second opinion. You can talk to their physician and see if the physician will put something in writing.
Oh, very good. Now, so you mentioned the test, and it just spurred the idea here. So folks, there are Alzheimer's tests, for example, or there's what's called the mini mental test, and there's variations on that. But I was at a conference recently, and there was an Alzheimer's expert, and she said, so you can't take those tests. Exactly what Amy just said. You can't take those tests. Have someone take the test and definitively say that person has Alzheimer's or dementia, and here's why. And this might seem a little odd, but you might have somebody who is dumb. I hate to say it, but they just, you know, you give them some questions and it's just confusing because they don't, you know, they're not the brightest light in the package. So you might have that, or and then the flip side of it, you might have someone who actually has some dementia and they're showing signs of it. So it's exactly what Amy said. There's some tests, but they're not necessarily definitive. So Amy, how do you narrow that down? What do you do?
Well, once again, that bar is very low. I mean, as a society, we want to err on the side that people have capacity. Here's the Oscars coming up. We've probably, a lot of us have seen the movie Nebraska. There is a character with, you know, diminished capacity. He's heading off to claim his $1 million reward. Is he acting rationally? No. Is he acting in his best interest? No. But then aren't we all guilty of that at times?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And at what point do you say that diminished capacity is to such an extent that they can't sign legal documents? And I will say the bar is very low. We want to err on the side of people determining their own destiny, being in charge of their own bodies and their bank accounts.
So it's interesting. Now, let me ask you something. So can you give me a sense, maybe not from your specific practice, but just overall, is it more common for people to wait until there is a crisis, or are you seeing more people become more proactive and put something in place today?
Well, I wish I could say that people don't wait for crisis conditions, but it does. Unfortunately, that's often the case. But any really major life change, I think when someone has a baby and they realize, you know, I'm not immortal. I need to put things into place so my child is taken care of. They might move to a new state and not have documents that were generated in that state, and they are unsure if they're still valid and what's going to, you know, how they'll be applied. Mm-hmm. So any major life change, I think, is a time to revisit this. And those are the times when people often will give me a call.
So don't wait. I mean, I just can't emphasize it enough. The aging population here, folks, in California is expected to grow by a whopping 44% in the next 9 years. The study that I cited was done a year ago, so the clock is ticking. And there are not enough facilities to support the aging population. And the problem with that is if you have an instance of diminished capacity, or perhaps it's capacity where you basically have lost your rights, your ability to enter into agreements, it's not the time to call. I cannot emphasize that enough. Your choices are taken away from you. It's much better to have something in place so that you can have a document, as we talked earlier, speak for yourself.
And if people are afraid to do this planning, this pre-planning, I just like to remind them, and I make the analogy of, you know, sex education in the schools. Just like learning the facts of life doesn't make you pregnant, signing a will won't kill you. Planning for long-term care doesn't sentence you to dying in a nursing home. So instead, really the opposite is true. Once you take control, you're making decisions for yourself. You're delegating responsibility, this responsibility to people who love you and care for you. Then you're really empowering yourself, and I find it's a very empowering experience for the whole family.
Now, there's a really interesting message here. So what I got from that was your sex life will improve if you sign a will.
I don't know if that's what I said. I'll have to listen to the recording.
I just was certain that that's what I heard. So I'm going to get mine all polished off today, I assure you. But seriously, folks, you know, these documents, I understand that they're difficult. You know, we do everything that to avoid having these kinds of conversations. But here's the thing. You drive a car, you have an insurance policy. Are you planning on getting in a wreck? No, but it's a pretty big investment. You have a home, you probably have homeowner's insurance. Why? Is your house going to burn down? Probably not. But if it did, you'd be devastated. And yet the single biggest expense we're going to see in our lifetimes are probably medical and long-term care expenses. And remember, we're on the Money Network here. We're talking about financial preservation. And actually, that's Amy's message. Have documents that speak for you in the moment that you can't. Make sure that your estate is protected. If you plan on passing some inheritance on to someone, you got to get these documents in order. There's much, much more here that I unfortunately, we're not going to have time to go over. Will you come back?
I would be happy to. Thank you, Terry.
And how can people reach you if they want to get more information about your services?
You can go to my website, www.ochilaw.com. And Ochi is like Sochi Olympics without the S. So it's Ochilaw, ochilaw.com. My phone number is 916-960-2202.
Now, I want to just kind of summarize things here. There's three pillars that make up a care roadmap. There's proper estate planning, wills, durable power of attorney, and what we've been talking about for the last few minutes about health care directives. Now, we've seen where health care directives are critical. We talked about the Bill of Rights, and it guarantees you bodily protection and integrity and ensures that it'll remain in effect if you're not able to speak yourself, if you have a health directive. You have a plan of care. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of a plan of care. Begin enacting that care with a trusted facility like Henry's facility, or in the home with a support team like Senior Helpers. You know, that our mission is to help avoid accidents, injuries, and illness. And unfortunately, that's times where Amy sees clients because they're dealing with critical issues in a crisis atmosphere. And by the way, care also helps avoid falls, and falls are the leading cause of accidents, the second leading cause of death. And America falls, you know, falls can easily translate into head injuries, and head injuries result in the loss of capacity. So you kind of see how that goes. So our population is aging. It's aging fast. As the UC Berkeley study said, we're going to see a 44% increase surge, if you will, a whopping surge of 44% in the next 9 years. We're actually on the downhill side of that now. And I want to tell you, next week, if you have a question about Medicare, Medicare Advantage, Medicare supplement plans, Medicare, anything about Medicare, tune us in. Don't forget, get your free care roadmap at seniorsurvivalsourcefund.com. Call me at 916-671-5777. Have an outstanding rest of your day. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Terry.